Time now for Talking Animals.
Walks like an animal, talks like an animal, must be an animal, come hear the animal, talking animal, talking animal. Walks like an animal, talks like an animal, must be an animal. Come hear the animals, talking animals, talking animals.
Good morning. This is Talking Animals. That was our new Talking Animals theme by the fabulous Rebecca Pulley. More on Rebecca and her great music can be found at RebeccaPulley.com. That's RebeccaPulley.com. Hey, the WMNF Summer Membership Drive is on the horizon. I'll be seeking your support for Talking Animals 3 weeks from today, June 5th. I'll talk a little bit more about this later in the show, but I hope you'll consider making an early pledge. How about right now? Via my tip jar, go to WMNF.org, click on the schedule, click on Talking Animals, and at the top of the Talking Animals page, you'll find my tip jar. If you like what we do here, put in $25, $50, will you? All right, today my guest is Ian Hallett, Hillsborough County Director of Animal Services, who recently prepared and presented to the County Commissioners his Be the Way Home plan. The plan includes some 60 initiatives intended to reduce the county's euthanasia rate, or, more positively, increase the save rate, and outlines a feral cat program, amongst other things. Earlier this month, commissioners approved that plan in a 6-1 vote. So, with the reminder that we invite you to join the conversation, time permitting, by calling 813-239-9663 or emailing us at dj@wmnf.org. Let's welcome Ian Hallett to Talking Animals. Good morning, Ian.
Morning, Duncan.
Thanks so much for joining us on Talking Animals, and in studio, no less. We, as I say all too frequently, perhaps, it's all too rare to have our guests in person and face-to-face and eye contact and all the cool things. So, very cool. Thank you. So, but my estimate, we have about 3 or 4 hours of material to cover here. So, I say we jump in and talk fast. So, although you assumed the job of Director of Animal Services for Hillsborough County from a similar post in Austin, you actually grew up in Riverview. So with apologies to Thomas Wolfe and others, you can go home again. Let's take a moment and touch on the Riverview years, particularly maybe as it pertains to animals. Were you what kind of animals did you grow up with? What was your household like?
No, well, personally, I just grew up with cats and dogs, but there were a lot of cattle and horses around, and we kept them on our property for the neighbors. And neighbors had goats and ducks and all of those things that come with rural life. But we were a dog and cat family. And
did you so sort of throughout your childhood years there was at least one or more animals floating around?
Yeah, and I was the traditional kid that loved all the animals and tried to bring them home and
tended to the sick and injured. Yeah. Probably, yeah. So I somehow guessed.
Yeah, and when you like animals, everybody tells you you should be a veterinarian. Actually started as a veterinary technician at Riverview Veterinary Hospital when I was 15.
Oh wow!
Volunteering and then went on staff when I was 16.
Really?
Yeah. So
wow. as a vet tech.
Yeah. Wow. And then did that all through college as well as I was prepping to go to, get my veterinary medicine degree. So and become a veterinarian. And then
what happened? Where would you go to college? First of all,
I went to New College of Florida down in Sarasota.
Okay.
And that was kind of where my path kind of diverged and went in a new direction. I got involved in wildlife rehabilitation in Sarasota while working on domestic or companion animals.
Mm-hmm.
And then got interested in wildlife economics. And so by the end of my undergraduate degree, I decided to go into a doctoral program in economics, focusing on wildlife conservation.
Wow. And is that what happened, or
That's what took me out to Austin in 2003. Was a economics doctoral program.
Wow.
Yeah, and I lasted a semester.
Oh, okay. All right. I thought that you were telling like there was some sort of twist or punchline coming. So I guess that was it then. So.
Yeah. After that, I went to the public policy school.
I gotcha. Yeah. And so what kind of degree did you end up with then?
Master of Public Affairs.
Okay. Cool. Yeah. Cool.
Which turned out to be the perfect degree for shelter management.
Right. So again, it was the initial academic venture that took you to Austin. And then as you completed that schooling, I guess the idea of working in animal services, I mean, how did that come together? You had grown up with cats and dogs, but veered off the veterinary path, and then
Growing up in Riverview, I'd never been to the county shelter, and out in the country, people didn't really call animal control, so I had no interaction with animal control. I literally did not know that it existed, and certainly didn't know that shelters existed. So I didn't go into the shelter for the first time until I was 23. And that was at Austin Animal Services. I started there as a volunteer and I loved it, but it was still just a volunteer thing to do on the side.
Mm-hmm. And what year was this then, Ian? I'm trying to.
I would have been moved to Austin in 2003.
Okay.
And then probably started volunteering around 2005.
Okay. So that's when you first kind of started at Austin Animal Services in a volunteer capacity or at all, really.
Yeah, that's correct.
Okay.
And I always wanted to work with companion animals, but. Had lived, my wife was in the Peace Corps in Central America, and I moved down there with her and saw immense poverty, and always had this nagging guilt about working on companion animal issues when there were kids that had no food and, you know, and dying young. And when Katrina happened, Austin became kind of a shelter for those people. And I saw in the news people who stayed behind simply because they couldn't take their pets with them. And perished in the process. And that's when I realized that companion animals were more than just a luxury for a lot of people.
Yeah.
They were their kind of source of life, their only companionship. And that's when I realized that I could make a difference in the world, not just for animals, but for a large number of people, you know, 60%+ of households who own an animal and treat it like family. And,
sure.
It kind of relieved my guilt about working in the field. And so once that happened, I became a volunteer and then I just loved it and dove into it, you know, 100%.
And so I take it just through volunteering in different capacities, then you obviously learned your way around. And then when did your sort of employment track, if that's the right term even here, begin?
Began in the fall of 2007, October 1st, the beginning of their fiscal year. It just so happened that I was graduating at the exact same time that an animal care supervisor position had opened. And I'd actually gone a year or so earlier to interview the director and ask what she did, because I was curious about how I could make a career working with companion animals and sheltering. And so after that, we formed a relationship, and she gave me my first shot at a management job in animal sheltering. So,
but boy, it really sounds like, in the way that's obviously kind of a classic path, there's other paths, but whatever the field is, I mean, you really sort of got in at the very floor and, you know, literally probably scrubbing floors and doing stuff as a volunteer and had all these volunteer positions and then got hired kind of at a, you know, initial kind of position. It just sounds like you sort of just kept moving up and learning along the way, and so that everything that happened later you had already been steeped in.
Oh yeah, absolutely. I couldn't have picked a more interesting time to get involved. When I started in 2005 as a volunteer, the euthanasia rate was 50%, and of course I was there through the transition to kind of the no-kill movement. And when I left, we had been at 90% for 14 straight months. So I've literally lived in both worlds at a large municipal shelter that takes in 20,000 animals. And in fact, you know, the largest municipal open admission shelter to reach 90%. So I was just right place at the right time.
Right.
And just, it was amazing.
And how did that experience, since you said you've been on both sides, I mean, how did that kind of shape your own philosophy about as you moved up into, you know, positions of obviously greater responsibility and kind of probably supervisorial elements? Yeah. I mean, what did that do, seeing, especially as they started moving towards a no-kill direction? Like, what were you thinking, like, as I have more say over this, or maybe some other shelter at some point or whatever. How did that inform kind of what you did, or just the way you looked at things in the shelter world?
Well, I got to see how the sheltering world tackled the issue traditionally before the no-kill movement, and got a chance to understand that. And then when the no-kill movement started, I got to see that different philosophy and then how it applied in the shelter. So whereas walking into a shelter, let's say, that's already achieved that or that is in the process of going there, I got to see what it was like beforehand and then see what it was like afterhand.
Up close, really, too.
Yeah. And it probably helped that I was only in that environment for about 2 years. Before we made the shift. And so I was still very pliable because there were previous movements that had failed create change. And a lot of my colleagues, you know, this was just yet another one that, you know, from a historical point of view would probably fail like the others. And so having not been through one of those, it was easier to keep an open mind and to try things.
So is that partly what you mean by more pliable? Because to me, it also sounds like, were you just dubious about the fact that this could work based on what you'd already seen with some similar attempts just in your tenure there?
Sure. Austin had produced a plan, the No-Kill Millennium, in 2000, and the community spent a bunch of time writing it, and then it got shelved. And so there was already kind of a precedent there. They were unable to kind of maintain the momentum after writing the plan. So there was already one precedent that was less than, you know, that was only less than 10 years old at the time of an attempt to go that route that had failed. But the no-kill movement that exists now is much more organized, and I think in a lot of cases better informed about the realities of large intake shelters. And so, and also more informed about political organizing and awareness and campaigning.
And that kind of machinery and how it can work for and against, I guess, a certain sort of movement or measure. So one thing I think we should do, and throughout this conversation, I think today, is there's sort of a lot of terms that we probably need to be careful to define. Mm-hmm. And similarly, there's some semantic issues that sometimes come up with some of this. But let's first just say, for people listening who may not know exactly what no-kill really means.
Well, no-kill is a political movement and a sheltering movement, and they kind of picked a number of 90%, that if 90% of the animals left alive, that all of the animals that could be saved were saved. Because there's a portion as an animal control agency that animals that are too aggressive or too injured to be released back to the community. And so the rough, I guess, kind of rule of thumb that developed out of that is there's probably about 10% of the population that enters a shelter that is collectively understood in the movement as to not be savable.
Okay. So that's where we get the 90%.
That's right. And
so, but that's in the kind of idealized no kill view of the world.
Right.
Of shelters.
And that came out of the fact that, actually, as you bring up semantics. And so for a while there, you had shelters saying, well, we don't euthanize any adoptable animals. Well, everybody was using different definitions for what was adoptable. In one shelter, an animal that sneezes is, medically irredeemable.
I see. So it's a very sliding scale there, I guess. Right.
Yeah. And there could also be pressure for people to define animals as adoptable or unadoptable according to political pressure to either perform or...
Right, because they're probably trying to hit certain numbers or avoid certain numbers.
Right. Yeah. And I think that was one of the genius parts of the movement was to say, look, we're going to quit talking about categories. It's, 90% is the goal. Now that also has its downsides, which I'm not, 90% in Austin Animal Services would look different at Hillsborough County Animal Services.
How so?
We have a very active animal cruelty unit. So we have a greater number of animal cruelty cases coming into the shelter.
Are you talking about here?
Yeah, here in Hillsborough County. More hoarding situations. Mm-hmm. And when you have a hoarding situation, the animals tend to be sick on intake. And
so they're going to land sick. More in that 10% then, I guess.
Right, but that 10% yeah,
right,
not
alters
be
your other overall percentages.
Right.
I see.
So,
yeah.
We have many cruelty investigators here, whereas in Austin, they were out of the Austin Police Department, and there were only a couple of them, so we did not have as many cases coming into the shelter.
So, and so were there just fewer cases in Austin, or was it the way it was structured, as you're saying, like where those kind of cases landed that that didn't have as much impact directly on the Austin shelter as it does here? Is it, I mean, in other words, was it comparable in terms of the number of hoarding cases, for example, or other things, and just the way it was sort of administered was different?
Well, I mean, we know that there's still cruelty cases. Well, I say we know. We suspect that there's more cruelty out there than what we're finding just because yeah. there's 1.2 million people. So really, much like police work, you know, the more resources you dedicate it to, kind of the more that you find. And so Hillsborough County's always had had an active interest in reducing the amount of animal cruelty in the community, which I think is a good thing because
sure.
the welfare of the animals in the community is equally as important as what happens to them when they get to the shelter. The difficulty it raises for us is that the type of animals coming into the shelter, the composition is different.
I see. Yeah. So, okay. So, the idea then is, and are you employing here, are you employing no kill, the actual term no kill, or just more the philosophy? Because so far, I don't know. I mean, I originally was going to print out in preparation for talking to you today, the Be Your Way Home thing. And then my printer said, no way, buddy, no way. So I took some selected things. But have you largely kind of not used that term generally since arriving at Hillsborough? Or?
That's correct. Hillsborough has been a real interesting case. It has not used the really strong rhetoric like what occurred in Austin. For example, the local no-kill advocacy group is actually called Save 90, focusing on saving 90% of
the
animals
positive,
as opposed to the no-kill.
Right.
And the county administrator also felt strongly because of the implications for staff of the word killing, you know, at a shelter. It's a very tough term to swallow as a shelter employee.
Sure.
And out of concern for the employees and also in trying to create a positive atmosphere or focusing on, you know, positive aspects of the operation, the county has chosen not to use that language. And so in that sense, Hillsborough County will be somewhat of an experiment in whether the model works without the rhetoric, which honestly, the rhetoric, you know, when you say kill, people's ears perk up and then
right.
they kind of listen to the next part of the message. And
right.
so while it's a negative term, it's very effective at raising awareness. So Hillsborough County will be somewhat a little bit of an experiment of whether that awareness can be raised without very exciting rhetoric.
Yeah, and again, I already kind of mentioned this before, but just in some of the comments you've just made, again, it just underscores how important semantics are to this world. Because, you know, and I've explained why here, even though the idea is to embrace the philosophy and practices of no-kill, you're not really using or allowed to use, I guess, no-kill. And then really itself, you know, euthanize, of course, is the classic euphemism
right.
for, you know, killing a cat, a dog, or whatever the animal is. And there's others that we'll get into, I guess, as we talk. But, I mean, it just to me, it requires to be so careful in listening and trying to decode, especially because these issues, as we may get into, I've already gotten some emails, and I'm sure I'll get some calls. By the way, this is Talking Animals. If you just tuned in, my guest is Ian Hallett, Director of the Hillsborough County Animal Services. If you'd like to offer a question or a comment, please call 813-239-9663 or email dj@wmnf.org. And as time permits, we'll include those in our conversation, although I have a lot of stuff I would like to cover with Ian myself. But anyway, yeah, so these are very kind of emotionally charged issues and often sort of polarizing, but let's and I know we'll come back to semantics one way or another, but let's talk more about the Bead the Way Home plan. I mean, it's ambitious and features some 60-odd initiatives, I guess, intended to reduce the county's euthanasia, right? Just did air quotes, folks listening at home. So as architect of this plan, what would you say are the most significant components of the plan? I mean, there's obviously a lot to it, but just in our limited time here, if you were forced to identify, say, two or three really key components, what might those be?
The first biggest one is marketing, and it's really the area that municipal shelters neglected. And we're seeing it all across government that citizens have a lack of awareness of all the things that the government does, and never really thought about investing like a company would in reaching citizens and advertising our services and our mission and all that we do. And that was true in animal services. So in Austin, we were always saving, you know, employees were taking animals home with broken limbs and giving them cage rest and bringing them back. We never thought to put that on a Facebook page or tell anybody we did that, or tell anybody that the animal needed a home. It's just what we did.
Right.
And we started to kind of see that we needed to tout all of the positive things that we were doing, and that we needed to spend, you know, we needed to spend some time and effort on making people aware in the general public of the number of animals euthanized and about all of the benefits of adopting. And we needed to use the same mechanisms that a company would: billboards, bus wraps, radio advertisements, TV advertisements. And if you look at, for example, the foot traffic at Hillsborough County Animal Services is much lower than it is in Austin. So when we look at all the different levers we could pull to increase adoptions, well, to me, the first most fundamental one is I need more people walking through the door. And having moved here, I never knew where the shelter was growing up here. When I tell people what I do, it's really funny. I say I work for animal services, and they say, oh, that's wonderful, I got my dog from the Humane Society too. And I'm like, well, no, we're animal services. And they're like, oh, you're the dog catcher. And I was like, well, no.
We're getting there.
No, we actually have a shelter, and we have, you know, 300 animals right there, you know, right now that you could adopt. And, oh, really? Well, where are you located? So the level of awareness of the sheltering aspect of Hillsborough County Animal Services is very low. And so in that sense, we have very low-hanging fruit there. All we need to do is get out the message that that aspect of our operation exists and what our hours are, which, by the way, are 10 to 7 every day.
And those have changed since you've arrived,
correct,
I believe, right?
Yeah. Our hours were really hard to remember before. So this is actually another example of marketing, even though it doesn't involve advertisement. But our hours, when I got here, it was Tuesday to Friday, 9 to 6, Saturday, 9 to 3:30, Sunday, 11 to 3:30, closed on Monday. Owner surrenders on Tuesday, Wednesday, Friday, intake on Tuesday to Saturday. And people, when I would tell them, their eyes would roll back in their head, and I knew immediately I needed to come up with something that I could say quickly that everybody remember. And now on Sundays, I mean, the word has gotten out pretty well, and people just know. They're like 10 to 7 every day. I mean, they just show up without having...
Yeah.
A
it's
lot
simple.
Of effort behind
right.
it.
Right, and you want to make it easy for people, right?
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
Yeah. So, okay, so marketing is obviously one of the key components. What would be one or two more if you were just limited to those?
Yeah. Off-site adoptions are really important. In particular, in Hillsborough County, because the geography is so different, we were very centrally located in Austin, Travis County. Brandon's actually pretty centrally located, except you have this giant finger, and then we extend way up to the northwest, to town and country, and then you have all this open area to the east, out to Plant City. And actually, the GIS department, Autumn Schwab, a wonderful person, animal lover, produced GIS maps of where our adoptions came from, and it's in the Be the Way Home plan, and they're all in Brandon and Riverview. I mean, there's hardly anything coming out of Plant City, New Tampa, Temple Terrace, and yet there's no shelters nearby any of those people. So we have huge markets that we haven't tapped. So off-site adoptions are something that are really important, in particular for animals that are not as adoptable as others. You need to get them at the shelter. They're competing with 200 or 300 other animals. You need to get them out by themselves so people can see them shine on their
sure.
own.
Sure, right. Isolated from whatever else is going on maybe
right.
at that moment.
Yeah.
All right, and if you were given one more slot, number three would be what?
That's a tough one. I think fostering is a big one because, for example, bottle babies, we get in 2,000 kittens each year that need to be nursed. And that is something traditionally we thought in sheltering was impossible to find that. But what was amazing in Austin is they actually developed a trailer in the hip area of town where the nightlife was, and they created a nursery, and people did shifts and would come in and feed all the bottle babies. So rather than the traditional model had been, I send you home with a baby kitten, and I need to find volunteers who are willing to wake up every 3 hours and feed a kitten. And people usually do that once and then never again.
Well, you know, and a few weeks ago we had Jack Talman in here and talking about just the importance of fostering and how that works, and especially about the babies and just getting them far enough along where they make it past the cutoff, or otherwise, again, a bad fate awaits if
right.
they can't hang in there and be adopted, or at least go into that adoption pool. So, okay, so those are the three. Marketing, offsite adoption, fostering. I know it was a tough call, and I'm sure there's a lot of things that we're vying for that third slot at least. But under the plan, the save rate, again, that is to say the percentage of animals that and correct me if I don't have you know this right, that enter the shelter system and remain alive. In other words, obviously are not euthanized or killed. It appears you're targeting a 70% rate in the first couple of years, or is that?
I tried to not to commit to a particular number. There's some disadvantages that come with that, is when you're trying to hit a particular number, you can actually make decisions that are, you know, driven by numbers. But walking around the shelter and looking around, and based on my previous experience, I look around and I think to myself, 70% of these animals can go to a home with not a huge investment. So I consider that if I came to anything less than 70%, I would consider myself as having failed. Now, how high we go beyond that is, you know, really up to the community and resources and us, animal services.
Right, because, you know, I, and I'm sure more than a few others, thought upon looking at you know, that based on your track record in Austin, where the save rate went, I think, from 45% to 90% within the first year or so of going to
no-kill.
Not the
first year.
First 2 years? It was somewhere. It was fairly soon, I think. It was pretty dramatic, it seemed.
We probably went from 60 to 90 in 3 years.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. So anyway, yeah, I guess it just seemed a little modest. But then just even what you said earlier in our conversation about the whole element of the cruelty hoarding thing, seems like you're up against an additional obstacle to at least initially get much beyond 70%, although it sounds like it's very well possible, and it'd be great obviously if you did, but that was why you probably set the initial target at that number.
Right. Yeah, I wouldn't be satisfied if we came in less than that.
Right, but also why you didn't set it higher, I guess is what I'm
correct.
Also,
yeah. And the board motion was, and this is unique to Hillsboro, the board motion didn't set a target either.
When you say board motion, what is...
To create this plan.
Okay.
They said they wanted to improve the save rate, whether that be 70, 80, or 90, that they were not putting a numerical target on it, but that they, which I agreed with, that we could go much higher than we were currently at. And so that was a mandate. And again, that's kind of unique to Hillsborough County. And I don't think unwise on their part. In Austin, you know, we took... more risk in placing animals that had prior behavioral issues, you know. So I kind of appreciate that that the county is asking me to make good decisions and to improve things and then reevaluate where we're at.
And in your experience, I mean, not just in Austin and so far here, but obviously I'm sure you're pretty steeped in the sheltering world just generally. When a shelter starts down the path that you guys did some years ago, obviously in Austin, and that we're starting now here at, in Hillsborough County. Is it pretty steady, like the way those numbers go? Like, let's say you're targeting 70% now. You know, you said you might exceed that, which would be great. But I mean, over, say, 2 or 3 years time, and again, if this is in the Be the Way home plan, I didn't get to that page.
That's okay.
But is it always steady in the direction of progress, or are there too many other variables that sometimes there's a little up and down over 2, 3, 5 years time?
Oh, the situation's very different for dogs and cats.
Right.
So dogs are around 65-70% now, and I've told my staff that's when it gets really hard. That's when you're having significant behavior issues. That's when you have significant medical issues, and those are going to require more resources, and they're going to be harder to find homes for, as you're looking for that special person who's willing to take on a hardship case. Then you look at cats, where 80% are being euthanized. So, you know, easily 50% of those are perfectly healthy house cats, and all I need to do is make sure enough people come through my shelter and that I advertise them and that I get them out to offsite so that people will adopt them. There's nothing else other than awareness and availability and accessibility that I need to solve there. So it is the cats that's really holding down our overall save rate. So that's our Achilles heel. But it's low hanging fruit too. I mean, we're really going to be able, the cats are going to go up very quickly and the dogs are going to climb much more slowly because we're getting into the more complicated cases.
Well, we're going to get into cats, including feral/community cats in a moment. But again, this is Talking Animals. I'm Duncan Stress. My guest is Ian Hallett, Hillsborough County's Director of Animal Services. And we do invite you to join the conversation by calling 813-239-9663 or emailing dj@wmnf.org. So let's get into at least a few of the emails that have come in. We'll just sort of skip around. This one says, Be the Way Home calls for increased participation in foster programs as one way to help reduce the euthanasia rate. However, the city of Tampa code currently limits the number of animals allowed in a household to 4. Will potential foster families living in the city be able to legally provide temporary housing for homeless pets if doing so increases the number of animals in the home above that limit?
That's something the Tampa City Council is working through right now, and because it's not part of our code, I have made myself available to discuss, you know, the issue and,
sure,
and provide education.
Yeah.
But as an employee of a county agency, I'm not, you know, in a position to, you know, to comment on City of Tampa policy.
Although I think, as this emailer implies, I mean, you'd think there would be or could be an exemption made in that situation, you know, to allow people temporarily, at least, to go beyond the 4, the limit of 4 to a household.
Yeah, I mean, it's certainly a possibility, and yeah, it certainly exists in other places. So.
All right, we have many more emails, but let's get one of our callers on. Hi, you're on Talking Animals with Ian Hallett.
Hi, Duncan. This is Chuck.
Hi.
Yeah, my county that I live in, it claims to have a no-kill policy on cats. I'm talking about feral cat problem down here.
Okay, and when you say down here, where are you calling from, Chuck?
Manatee County.
Okay.
And the problem is, I've heard, I'm not sure this is true or not, but I've heard that they're cat dumping. They're dumping these cats out, and that's a threat to the birds, you know, the wildlife in the area. We got a lot of rare birds and all.
Mm-hmm.
But it's a complicated problem because the coyotes, I think, are eating a lot of the cats that they dump, and now we're having a coyote population problem. And my fear is that the coyotes are going to start attacking people.
Okay, well,
a coyote ate my cat, a calico cat, Lucy, recently. So, you know, it was what, about 8-10 months ago. So,
geez, very sorry to hear that,
so,
Chuck.
You know, it's a complicated thing. This cat, the no kill thing, you know, and I just wonder, you know, what's being done in my county to address it.
Well, I don't know that Ian can speak to what's being done in your county, but Ian, maybe you'd like to just at least more broadly address it and specifically how that might apply to Hillsborough County.
Sure. And in fact, you know, as I mentioned, I started in a doctoral program for the economics of wildlife conservation, and then my public policy degree, all of my electives were in wildlife conservation. So I spent a lot of time studying this. not necessarily with the intention of getting into feral cat issues. But what I think the caller is bringing up is that cats, whether, you know, set aside the fact that whether they're native or non-native, they have become a part of the ecosystem. In Hillsborough County, there's estimated to be between a minimum of 200,000 free-roaming cats, and Fish and Wildlife puts it at 400,000 free-roaming cats. And so they are out there, and if you were to suddenly remove them, you would have significant ecosystem impacts on both native and non-native species. And it's interesting, I was reading a peer-reviewed article in Conservation Biology, and said that actually invasive species can wind up playing a critical ecosystem role that might have been vacated by an endangered species. And what's interesting is bobcat populations have declined significantly in Florida, and it's the only state in the United States where bobcats have declined. And so actually domestic cats are probably playing some of the same ecosystem roles as the bobcat. So it's really complex. If you pull cats out of the equation, you're going to see all kinds of other downstream effects. So what we're seeing and what the caller's mentioning are upstream effects, which is an increase in coyotes.
Sure. Chuck, thank you for your call. We're going to move on because we're already running desperately out of time.
Thanks, Duncan.
Thanks for your call. Okay, so Ian, we are somehow, you know, well, we're going to stretch things. I'm already throwing things overboard to make more time. But anyway, and you still have a bit more time to stick around and talk?
Or? Oh, absolutely.
Okay, good.
And there is one email I wanted to answer out there.
Okay, well, we'll get to that in a sec, but because there's a few here, and there's of course, we got a couple callers already. And you know, I think this is a good time. Chuck's call and some of the emails is a good time to note that, you know, the in some ways, the centerpiece of the Be the Way Home plan, at least in my reading of it, is the pilot community cat program. So maybe you could outline some of the key tenets of the plan and how they connect to your broader vision of where Hillsborough County Animal Services should be headed.
Yeah. Well, to back up, this type of program began in Jacksonville under the name Feral Freedom. And the idea there behind this is that the cats already exist out there. And so if we can get them one rabies vaccination and get them spayed and neutered so that they don't continue to contribute to the problem, then we're better off than where we started from. Now, a free-roaming cat doesn't live as good of a life as an indoor-only house cat. But if we can prevent them from creating more problems, the situation is better than it was. So it's not an ideal situation, but it's still not a good situation, but it's better than it was before. The other concept underlying this is that in most cases, when the cat is healthy, it's thriving in the environment. And actually in most cases, it's thriving in an urban environment. And in fact, it's being fed by somebody. There's in Hillsborough County, well, about 10% of the population and as high as 25% in an Ohio study are feeding free-roaming cats. So most of them are somewhat domesticated in the sense that they depend on people for food. Some you can pet and they are as friendly as the cat you own. Other ones won't let you get near them, and some people spend 10 years and then they're finally able to pet them. But the idea is that they were existing and thriving in their current environment, so why do we want to take them in to the shelter and euthanize them when they were existing there before without problems? The Hillsborough County programs very different because it's very restricted compared to those programs. There's a cap on the number of cats that can go into it. There's a lot of restrictions about where they can be released. There's a lot of measures to try to prevent the cats from being nuisances to those who don't enjoy cats. So it's a very restricted program, which is what I think Hillsborough County needed, because the population here is more divided than Austin was on their opinion.
Philosophically divided,
cats.
You mean?
Yeah. Correct. Yeah.
All right. So one quick thing, Ian, just because I know we're going to run out of time, but do you know offhand, because I know the Be the Way Home plan is available online, so whether or not someone was ambitious enough to print it out, which I wasn't, but I mean, you can read it online. Do you happen to know like where that link or is there something where they can go to Animal Services and click on it there?
Right. It's on our homepage for Animal Services. So if you go to hillsboroughcounty.org and click on departments and then Animal Services, it'll be right there on the front page.
Okay.
And
for people who might be,
I would encourage people not to print it out.
Right. Oh my God. Yeah. When I thought, okay, well I can just ask some questions about this, about printing it out. Okay. So let's read one of these emails and try to get to one or two more if we can. And maybe one of our callers, we're just sort of running very short on time. But this says, as a lifelong lawyer and owner of all rescued cats, I appreciate those who wish to save feral cats, but I'm opposed to neutering them and returning them to the wild. Roaming feral and tame domestic cats are damaging to our indigenous species, and people and laws allowing this are not acting in a responsible way to our environment. Additionally, all roaming cats have the potential to spread communicable diseases, including feline leukemia and rabies. I find it interesting that Florida encourages the hunting of boa constrictors and other non-native reptilian and amphibian species and oppose the euthanasia of feral cats. I guess people are comfortable with the furry and not with scales. Also interesting that we don't have the same philosophy for dogs and cats. Well, obviously that was a mouthful, and I don't know that you can respond to all those, but just you know, in some sort of rather succinct way, maybe you could respond to the core idea there.
A lot of interesting points brought up there. One of which is that, you know, people are more concerned about the furry than the scales. That's actually very well documented. If you look at the endangered species list, there are far more mammals on there than there are reptiles and amphibians, even though there's actually more endangered reptiles and amphibians. So whether we like to admit it or not, our Endangered Species Act is geared towards cute and cuddly animals. So it's not geared towards the animals that are the most in danger. In terms of rabies and other diseases, I mean, any mammal is a threat to with rabies. A couple interesting facts. So we have in the last 20 years, there have been 300 cases in Florida of cat rabies. There's been 2,500 cases of raccoon rabies, and yet the Fish and Wildlife Commission doesn't trap them and do anything with them. We don't trap them and do anything with them. In fact, the only way to trap a raccoon is to do it yourself or to pay somebody a good amount of money to come in and do it. And then it's a lot of times they're actually released to other areas. Human rabies cases, of the 19 cases in the last 10 years, 10 to 15 years of human rabies, 17 of those came from bats. None of them came from cats. So if we were really concerned about human contact with rabies, we'd really be having to focus our efforts on bats and raccoons. Now, of course, bats and raccoons are indigenous, but if the concern is truly about rabies, then that's where we need to focus our effort.
Right.
It's kind of, I don't know what to say, that we're going to ignore rabies in an animal because it's indigenous, but we're going to address it in non-native species. From a health standpoint,
tricky.
It doesn't add up.
Yeah. All right. So again, this question, some of our conversation brings up more semantics. So community cats, roaming cats, feral cats are all pretty much interchangeable terms. And also, before we really run out of time, an important also semantic distinction is when people talk about TNR, sometimes it's always trap, neuter, but sometimes the R has become, for one reason or another, release, when it's really, ideally, it's return, right? Taking them from the colonies, you're doing the neuter, vaccination, et cetera, and then returning them where they came from, not just saying, hey, good luck, Charlie, and we're just setting you loose.
That's right. And that's an important part of it, is that if the cat comes in and it's healthy and it's thriving, then it needs to go back to where it was. You're taking a chance if you send it to some place that's unfamiliar to it. It also introduces a cat to an area where there wasn't a cat before, which has wildlife impacts. So returning it to where it was presumably does not make the situation any worse. And the fact that it's spayed and neutered hopefully will make the situation better.
And before we run out of time here, I'd be totally remiss, given the topic here and talking animals' relationship with music and animal songs and WNF's relationship with music and skippers, that on Sunday, May 26th, there's a benefit concert for Friends of Hillsborough County Animal Services at Skippers. Starts at 5 p.m. and a bunch of cool bands and all kinds of other things that you can do. And so I imagine there's probably more information about that on the Animal Services site, or certainly probably on the Skippers website, I would think.
Skippers, as well as the Facebook page for Friends of Hillsborough County Animal Services.
Cool. All right, we're desperately out of time, but Gilding the Lily here, I'm going to take one more call. Hi, you're on Talking Animals with Ian Hallett. If you have a brief comment or question, that'd be great. Hello, it's you.
Yes, hello. Thank you. I'm so happy you're here, Ian, and I am all for TNR, and I'm glad you made the distinction about return. But mandatory spay-neuter has to be implemented in this county, and I know a lot of people are against that, but it's a human problem. The humans are causing the problem, and the humans out there that are causing the problem will continue to cause the problem. And we all can keep doing our best to try to stop the suffering, which you are doing and many people are doing, ACT, et cetera. But it's just going to continue because there's irresponsible humans and there's got to be a law in place. I know they say it's hard to implement the law to, you know, get the actual people to stop, but they said the same thing about drunk driving, seatbelts. You know, there's got to be a law in the books because abandonment is rampant, and people that know about abandonment need to turn these people in, and, you know, and it's not happening, and it you know, won't happen. I do TNR myself, and I always have, but we have to have mandatory spay-neuter. Thank you. I'll hang up now.
Okay, thanks for your call and your comments.
Okay.
Thank you for your call. Thanks for your support.
Okay, so, gosh, Ian, well, there's emails we didn't get to, there's calls we didn't get to, there's a bunch of my stuff we didn't get to, but I guess to put this in the positive way, maybe we'll just have you back again at some point and have more conversations both about the stuff we didn't get to, and obviously there's I think, a lot of interest out there people with, you know, again, different philosophical views on some of these issues in particular, and we'll maybe give those people another chance to air those and find out more about kind of the plan and what you have in mind. So thank you very much. We've been speaking with Ian Hallett. He's, again, the director of Hillsborough County Animal Services. The website, one more time, is hillsboroughcounty.org/animalservices, and there's also a Facebook page for the Hillsborough County, Friends of Hillsborough County Animal Services, right? That's how you would search for it if you're trying to find that.
That's
page,
correct.
Right? Yeah, cool. All right, Ian, well, thank you so much, and we'll have you on again and talk again then on Talking Animals.
Thank you very much. Good to be here.
All right, good luck with your Be the Way Home plan.
All right.
We are going to skip, I'm afraid, the Comedy Corner for today. I think it's a good use of time that we did instead. So anyway, this is Talking Animals. I'm Duncan Strauss. In another moment or two, we'll play Name That Animal Tune. The winner will win a copy of Once Upon a Flock, Life with My Soulful Chickens, the new book by our recent guest, Lauren Scheuer. We'll do that shortly here on Talking Animals. Right now, let's hit a few announcements, news items, etc. First of all, a quick congrats and thanks to all who contributed to last weekend's tropical heat wave. Smash success on all fronts, near as I can tell. And so big kudos. And looking ahead a little bit, mentions the top of the show, but another important WNF event on the horizon is the Summer Membership Drive. It's June 5th through 12th, which means I'll be seeking your support for Talking Animals 3 weeks from today, June 5th. But it would really help me tremendously, though, if you consider supporting the show and me before then. About today. So if you like the show, like the work I do here, please go to my tip jar again. Go to WMNF.org. Click on the full schedule link, click on Talking Animals within that schedule, and at the top of the Talking Animals page is my tip jar. So if you could donate $25, $50, something like that, be really great. And again, I'll have those cool Talking Animals t-shirts for a $50 pledge, and I'll have all kinds of other special exclusive gifts like I always do, tickets and the condo in Kauai, etc. So keep an eye on TalkingAnimals.net. We'll get more of that information up probably by next week. And Geez, we're pretty much out of time, but I just want to quickly say, kind of apropos of our conversation last week with Paul Shapiro, the HSUS VP of Farm Animal Protection, that Governor Bill Haslam vetoed the anti-whistleblower ag-gag bill that we discussed at some length after hearing from thousands of Tennesseans urging the veto and a report deeming the bill constitutionally suspect by the Tennessee Attorney General. Also, yesterday, the Today Show did a pretty amazing for them piece on the controversy of the Bureau of Land Management's roundups of wild horses and burros, and like 6 or 7 minute piece, which is really long for them. Anyways, you can find that online if you didn't happen to catch it, and it's really, really well done. Lisa Meyer did a great job, and lots of other stuff that we just don't have time for today. So anyway, all right, so let's play Name That Animal Tune. And I gave this kind of short shrift last week, which I apparently am doing again this week, but this is a old song, newly recorded on a fairly prominent veteran rockers tour, but with a very cool guest. And so if you can name this animal tune, you'll win a copy of Once Upon a Flock, Life with My Soulful Chickens. See if you can name this animal tune. 813-239-9663 to the first person who can name this animal tune on Talking Animals. All right, if anybody happens to know, can decode that. They can call in and we'll take it off the air. 813-239-9662. We have just about reached the end of today's edition of Talking Animals on WMNF Tampa. I'll be back next Wednesday, May 22nd, when my guest will be Dr. Barbara Natterson Horowitz, a cardiologist at the UCLA Medical Center and co-author with Catherine Bowers of the best-selling book Zubiquity, The Astonishing Connection Between Human and Animal Health, recently issued now in paperback. I hope you'll join us for that next Wednesday. All right, every line is lit. Let's give people a chance to name that animal tune. Hi, you're on Talking Animals. Can you name that animal tune?
Yeah, Little Red Rooster playing by the Rolling Stones. Didn't write it, but there's...
Who was the guest vocalist?
You need to know that. No,
that's just a bonus point.
It sounded like Mick from what I heard.
But it was actually Tom Waits. Yeah, it was Tom Waits.
Okay,
cool.
Yeah.
Okay, what is your first name, sir?
Mark.
Mark, okay, I'll come back and get your information and send you off a copy of Once Upon a Flock, Life with My Soulful Chickens, the Lauren Shorey's new book that we talked about a couple
weeks ago. Yeah, I listened to that show last week. It was interesting.
Oh, awesome. All right, Mark, well, stay tuned. I'll get your information. Thanks.
Thanks, yes.
All right. Yeah, very cool version. In San Jose, or no, Oakland, I guess they did that a couple of Sundays ago. Anyway, so also I hope you visit our website, talkinganimals.net. Again, keep an eye on that. But in the meantime, if you go to WNF.org and support Talking Animals with the tip jar, that'd be great if I haven't already mentioned that twice. And, of course, on the Talking Animals website, we have archives, podcasts, information, links to the Facebook page, Twitter feed, and more. Talkinganimals.net for that. So I'm Duncan Strauss. Thanks very much for listening. Have a good week. Be kind to animals. Be kind to others. Be kind to yourself. And we're closing out today's show with an animal song from one of the 60-plus bands that performed over the weekend at WNF's Tropical Heatwave. This is Elastic Bond with Snake Charmer on WMNF, Tampa, Brandon, Clearwater, Largo, Weekiwachi, and beyond. Thanks for listening. Speak with you again next Wednesday at 9 a.m. on Talking Animals. Thanks.
Sound of an organ, traveling like a pterodactyl's wingspan soaring, over and through lands which remain foreign from pain, cause when it rains it's naturally pouring. Ah, your times beholding, quietly exploring, most sleep still, just silently snoring. I will my skill till they can't keep ignoring, climbing Zion's hill but my name ain't Lauren. Straight knees rhyming like Zion's spill, we're perfectly flowing. Hate these wannabes who don't believe in freestyle performing, do a demo as an album and the whole shit's generically wiggity whack boring. Hardcore out, plainly outdone, versions of the mic, dreaming the score in quarter one. This is
war begun and people got shunned back to the locker room before the resolution.
We play the rhythm like a snake charmer. You call it fate, but we call it karma. What's going on in the world today? Even the young are afraid. Wicked way is a drama. We play the rhythm like a snake charmer. You call it fate, but we call it karma. What's going on in the world today? Even the young are afraid. Wicked ways.
Thank you.